This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, A Seat on the Exit Row. Triangle entrepreneurs like Andy Widmark, Brian Handley, and Ben Weinberger have tasted big cash outs, but the billion-dollar deal remains elusive. And that's the headline on the front page. The actual story is inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Exit Strategies. Triangle entrepreneurs find it tough to execute mega deal. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge. It was a crisp January day when Digital Smith's founders, Ben Weinberger and Matt Berry, became millionaires, shifting the narrative. Pages of signatures and a $135 million check from TiVo later, the Digital Smith's deal was done, marking yet another tally on a Triangle list that is disproportionately short when compared to the sea of Triangle startups. Exits like Digital Smith seem to happen every day to starry-eyed garage geeks in Silicon Valley, where a California tech giant can see the potential in a couple of entrepreneurs and a dream. But there's still big news here. While the Triangle has seen a few big-ticket exits, ShareFile, iContact, Hosted Solution, Acipiter, blockbuster deals are rare. Compare that to Silicon Valley, where in the last few months alone, billion-dollar deals have repeatedly made headlines, such as WhatsApp's $19 billion exit via Facebook. Time and time again, we're told that funding is limiting our entrepreneurs, our distance from the Sandhill Road VCs, but as exits such as ShareFile and iContact confirm, the dollar barrier isn't absolute. Could it be a question of the technology we're selling? We asked the newsmakers, people like Weinberger and Brian Handley, whose Acipiter exit to Aquantive paved the way. We asked Andy Widmark, whose New Wave Surgical was purchased by Covidien earlier this year, and Aaron Houghton and Rich Lee, whose $168 million iContact and $310 million Hosted exits, respectively, are still inspiring entrepreneurs at American Underground and HQ Raleigh. They say getting an exit isn't as simple as pasting a for sale sign on your software. Strategy and luck play a role, and community support is essential. Does the Triangle have what it takes? The barriers. Weinberger, Handley, and Widmark point to venture capital as a driver behind their successes. Without it, exits are hard to come by. Getting capital to the Triangle often means getting on a plane. I was literally flying from one coast to another coast back-to-back days, Weinberger says. But ask Houghton and Lee and they'll tell you that might be a good thing. Too often, the entrepreneurs agree, startups think that the first step is capital. They say it's not. The expectation that one of the first things you do in a startup is go raise capital, it's a huge barrier to success, Houghton says. You need to have a product. You need to have a prototype. You need to have customers. You need to be breaking even before you raise capital. If not, you raise capital too early. While the angel community is significant in the Triangle, that $250,000 initial check might be far more expensive in equity than a larger infusion an entrepreneur might need down the road, Houghton says. They give up way too much of their business, then they don't control their role or control the decisions that get made in the long-term best interests of all the shareholders, Lee says. That also means a smaller check for those who do get that blockbuster exit. The people who already had money, investors, make money, and the entrepreneur makes a little bit of money, but not the kind of money that makes them go out and take risks, Houghton says. Without risks, there are no startups, and without startups, there aren't billion-dollar exits. The other barrier said to keep us from Silicon Valley-esque exits is the lack of community. In Silicon Valley, investor and River City's Capital Fund's venture capitalist, Rick Vandeveen, says the California giants, the sort who write those billion-dollar checks, are working alongside those startups. They see them at Starbucks or at the grocery store. There's access, he says. Triangle entrepreneurs have to rely on connections through their investors, and those investors are primarily located in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. It's hard to get them to fly out, Vandeveen says. While Vandeveen's local firm just raised a $200 million fund, that's a rarity, with most firms here shelling out under $500,000 per investment. There are dollars here, including Bull City Venture Funds, InterSouth Venture Partners, Pappas Ventures, and Aurora Funds, but there's no Sand Hill Road. I have a lot of friends on Sand Hill Road, and they used to say, it's hard to get there, Hatteras Ventures partner Bob Ingram says. No, it isn't. We now have a direct flight. The Triangle is taking steps to foster its own community. ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson, who works for Citrix these days, and other entrepreneurial activists such as Chris Gergen, Jason Wyden, and Brooks Bell, married to Lipson, have launched HQ Raleigh, an entrepreneurship hub in downtown Raleigh aimed at fostering startups and creating connections. And the American Underground Entrepreneurship System, complete with a Google partnership, has three hubs in Durham and Raleigh. Both entrepreneurship endeavors have indicated they'd like to branch out. It's a start, Weinberger says. We have the pieces in place. I think we can do it. But instead of counting the startups and bragging about a number, maybe it's time we brag about the exits. It's more about who does the buying, says Shark Tank celebrity investor Mark Cuban when asked about how to promote Triangle entrepreneurship. You need companies who are willing acquirers to be vocal about it. And we have an associated section called Deal Makers with the headline Big Money Exits. Listed below is a snapshot of selected local companies that sold for a substantial sum in recent years. Acipiter, Brian Hanley's first trek into entrepreneurship was owning restaurants and laundromats in the Triangle, but he decided to go back to college at North Carolina State University and met Chris Evans, owner of an online advertising software company called Acipiter. Joining the Acipiter team, Hanley began to stretch his technology legs. When the firm was sold to CMGI in 1998 for $230 million, he stayed on board, even as CMGI turned into Engage. When Engage decided to put its interactive division up for sale, Handley put up the cash, changing the name back to Acipiter and building it back up. He then sold the firm to Aquantive in 2006 for $30.3 million. Hosted, CEO Rich Lee, began with a $375,000 investment in a bankrupt data center company in Cary. In a few years, that cash drop turned into a $310 million exit when Windstream bought the company from PE firm Abry Partners. We felt like there were a lot of tailwinds in the sector and a lot of growth coming, Lee says. That enabled us to stay in the game. Eye Contact. Aaron Houghton co-founded Eye Contact with Ryan Alice while the pair were at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Alice was sitting next to Houghton at an entrepreneurship club meeting. Houghton built an email tool and the duo started marketing it with its own software. Houghton and Alice were rivaling IBM and Microsoft in business-to-business channel spending during the recession, a time when competitors were making cutbacks. But as the recession receded, the free fall was over, the business became more competitive, he says. Offers had been coming in since 2005, increasing in $10 million units. Every time a deal was accepted, however, it seemed to fall through, until Vocus came calling in 2011. And that brought a $169 million exit. Digital Smiths. Ben Weinberger and Matt Berry started Digital Smiths as an army of two in Illinois, later moving their company to South Carolina to seek financing. The move to the Triangle came in 2006, mainly for engineering and recruiting. Digital Smiths, a technology company that connects users to relevant video content, kept selling their solution, teaming up with the likes of Time Warner Cable and Fox Sports Mobile to advance the product and the customer list. When TiVo came calling, the company was working on an initial public offering backup plan that could have made it a public company in 2016. But TiVo's workforce culture was enough for Digital Smiths to sell for $135 million. And also we have a timeline of exits in the Triangle section. After 2004, exits started gaining momentum in the Triangle. Here's a look at the major sales of the past decade. 1998, Raleigh-based Accipiter is sold to CMGI, later called Engage, for $35 million. 2005, Google acquires Chapel Hill-based Skia. 2006, Accipiter, the internet division, is sold to Aquantive for $30.3 million. 2008, iRobot buys Durham's Necton Research. 2010, Hosted Solutions is sold to Windstream for $310 million. Intuit buys Kerry-based MedFusion for $91 million. Kerry-based SciQuest completes $57 million IPO. 2011, Raleigh-based ShareFile is sold to Citrix. 2012, Morrisville-based iContact is sold to Vocus for $169 million. Morrisville-based Tekelec goes private for $780 million. 2013, Oracle acquires Tekelec. Morrisville-based Channel Advisor successfully completes $80 million IPO. And in 2014, Durham-based DigitalSmith sells to Tebow for $135 million. And finally on this page, there's another section headlined, Exit Ahead, Five Companies to Watch in 2014. Valencell, spelled V-A-L-E-N-C-E-L-L. Valencell CEO Stephen LaBeouf is already a deal maker. He did it with South Korean firm iRiver, signing a deal to have his sensor technology in headphones. And he did it again with LG Electronics. LaBeouf tells us to expect more partnership announcements this summer. Raleigh-based Valencell's technology provides real-time biometric information with clinical-level accuracy. Could its next partner scoop up the whole shop? Max Point, an online advertising firm, was pegged as one of the two triangle firms to make the top 10 on Deloitte's Fast 500 list in 2013. CEO Joe Epperson has a lengthy resume, having served as a finance director for eBay. When asked which companies we should be watching, CEOs frequently point to the Morrisville firm and its technology, intended to help drive in store sales by helping advertisers reach neighborhoods online. Appia. Durham-based Appia has surpassed 75 million app installs on its mobile app network and is growing its headcount up to 86 employees by the 1st of May. CEO Judd Bowman has been on the record with his intent to get a big exit, and he's made some hires over the past year that have fueled IPO buzz, such as adding iContact CFO Tim Oakley. With more than $30 million in venture financing, a lot's at stake for Bowman. Bronto Software. The Durham email marketing company is a frequent contender of fastest-growing private companies lists, having recently gone international. CEO Joe Colopy, a former Red Hatter, is bullish about his company's growth. The company, which started in Colopy's spare bedroom, now touts a 216-person headcount. And NetCertive. Marketing software firm NetCertive has been on a hiring spree, with its CEO, Brendan Morrissey, telling us he doubled the employee roster in 2013. The plan is to hire an additional 70 in 2014, bringing the total to about 200 employees, and he's heard the IPO rumors that have been circulating about his company. Morrissey tells us that he is focused on building his business, but that if an opportunity arises, he'll certainly look at it. And now we turn to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by Managing Editor Rebecca Troyer. It's not a credit, it's an investment. Don't call it a tax credit. That's the message that the North Carolina Housing Coalition is sending out regarding proposed changes to the state's low-income housing tax credit program. The tax credit's been around since the late 1990s to help offset expenses for developers of housing for low-income families, but it is set to expire on December 30. Instead, call it the Workforce Housing Investment Program, says Carly Ruff, policy director for the coalition. There's a negative connotation with tax credits right now, and because ours operates more like a loan, we are now calling it WIP, Ruff told an audience of about 300 people attending the CAHEC annual conference at the Raleigh Convention Center on May 20. Most of the conference attendees were lenders, developers, and partners involved in low-income projects across the Southeast. Neomond Express to open at Rex Healthcare. Neomond Bakery and Deli is opening a food kiosk at Rex Healthcare in Raleigh. According to Rex Healthcare's Facebook page, a Neomond Express will open at the hospital in June. Neomond is a Lebanese and Mediterranean deli, bakery, and market that has been in business in the Triangle since 1977. It has two Raleigh locations, on Barrow Road and Strickland Road, and one in Morrisville. The Saleh brothers recently renamed the Strickland Road location Sassoul in honor of their mother, Cecilia. Comedy Channel features Carrie Story. Yes, that was really WNCN's Derek Waller on Comedy Central on May 22. Waller appeared in the clips at the end of Jon Stewart's show, reporting on a crime wave that rocked Carrie. Even though it annoyed some business owners when vandals wrote silly words on the exterior walls, Stewart picked up on Waller's reporting. It used to say booger and snot, Waller reports from Carrie, pointing to a brick wall where the offensive words had just been painted over. Bike to work in style with new Julian design. Fashion and furniture designer and Chapel Hill native Alexander Julian is not only reestablishing his roots in his hometown, he's also partnering with Chapel Hill-based Performance Bicycles, one of the nation's largest chains of bike stores. Together, they will roll out a new kind of cycling shirt in the next few weeks that can be worn to work, something supporters of the bike-to-work craze will appreciate. And while he wasn't able to go through with the chance to design a Ford concept car a few years ago, he will be designing a new bicycle he thinks will change the industry. I'm doing something for the commuter's bike, Julian says. I'm going to make it less expensive and dressy. It's going to be a gravel bike that is going to be colorful in ways no one has ever imagined a bicycle could be. High schooler shows his stuff at Rex Open. The big local story at the Rex Hospital Open at TPC Wakefield this year belonged to Alex Smalley from Wake Forest High School. He shot an even par May 24, but because of a 5 over par 76 on May 23, missed the cut. On five different holes on May 23, Smalley missed rolling in a putt by an agonizingly small amount, leading to increasingly loud ahs from the mostly friends and family that followed him that day. That's why golf, like many other sports, is a game of inches. The young amateur didn't go away empty-handed. Earlier in the week, Smalley won his division in the Rex Hospital Open Junior Invitational. This opportunity means the world to me, especially since I live about 10 minutes away, Alex said afterwards. Lucky patron wins big at DPAC celebration. Since the Durham Performing Arts Center's inception in 2008, the venue has hosted 530 performances, 180 concerts, and 60 comedians. And it now has yet another accolade to add to its repertoire. DPAC recently ended another season by celebrating the arrival of its 2 millionth guest. Cheryl Pettiford, who moved to the Triangle 2 years ago from New York State, just so happened to be that lucky guest. Little did she know that an employee of DPAC was looming in the background, ready to surprise her with a stream of confetti from a confetti cannon. And what all did Pettiford win for being the 2 millionth guest? For one, box seats for that night's performance of Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, and $1,000 towards future performances at DPAC. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, the page of Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. The first headline, Prominent Kroger Building Sold. A new owner has emerged for the empty Kroger retail store on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Southeast Raleigh. However, no plans have been revealed about a possible future tenant for the center. Andreas Kissel, owner of Market Street Partners of Nyack, New York, confirms that he and his investment partner have purchased the vacated Kroger building. But I can't comment beyond that, he says. Kissel also would not disclose any detail about the buyer group that's incorporated in North Carolina as 1610 MLK Boulevard LLC, according to Wake County deed records. Kissel's group had also bought another empty Kroger building in the Nashville, Tennessee area in 2013 for $2 million. In Raleigh, 1610 MLK Boulevard LLC paid nearly $2.7 million for the 60,300-square-foot building on 7 acres, which is less than half of the tax value for the property, pegged at $5.9 million. The New York Investor Group bought the building directly from the Kroger Company, which built and opened the retail center in 2003. Kroger closed the Southeast Raleigh store, one of the only major grocery stores serving the less affluent Southeast Raleigh neighborhoods, in January 2013. Kroger had also closed its Raleigh store at 4111 New Bern Avenue around the same time. Two Raleigh ministers have in recent weeks opened a small grocery store called The Galley in the former Watson Minute Market building at 402 Bragg Street to help fill the void for fresh produce and products in the community. Homeless Veterans Center gets federal boost with $4.2 million grant. A 5-year effort to open a 400-bed Veterans Life Center for homeless veterans at an unused state building in Butner received a major shot in the arm. The Raleigh-based nonprofit leading the effort, Veterans Leadership Council of North Carolina, CARES, has been awarded a $4.2 million grant via the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to begin building out the facility and offering services for homeless veterans. It is also one of the largest federal community development block grants awarded in the state's history. John Turner, executive director of the nonprofit, says the renovation of the building, known as Building 71 on the John Umstead Hospital Complex campus, will be the first of 8 buildings they expect to use by completion of the VLC. Turner says the VLC will employ about 26 people when it opens in early 2015, and it will have enough beds to house 150 veterans and their families on a temporary basis. And in a section headlined Closer Look, Newmark Grubb opens brokerage office in Raleigh. The New York-based Newmark Grubb Knight Frank commercial real estate firm is opening its first office in Raleigh, and 4 commercial brokers previously with the DTZ brokerage group in Raleigh will lead the new effort. Brad Armstrong will be the executive managing director for the Raleigh NGKF office. Joining him in the new Raleigh office at the Trust Atlantic building on Glenwood Avenue will be tenant representatives Doug Brock, Dan Thompson, and Jeff Berrios. Armstrong will also split much of his time between the Triangle and Newmark Grubb's headquarters in New York as part of a broader outreach to new clients, he says. And in the retail section, Toby Keith planning new restaurant in the Triangle. One of Toby Keith's signature restaurants, I Love This Bar and Grill, is coming soon to Cary's Parkside Town Commons. The restaurant will be a tenant in Phase 2 of the development, an area still undergoing construction in West Cary. The I Love This Bar and Grill restaurant chain, named after country star Keith's 2003 hit I Love This Bar, features guitar-shaped bars, servers dressed like cowgirls, live country music, and Toby Keith-themed gift shops. Planet Fitness moving to University Mall. As part of a retail overhaul, University Mall in Chapel Hill will add a Planet Fitness gym to fill about half of the old Rose's Discount Store space, which closed in early April. It will be the first Planet Fitness gym in Chapel Hill and should open in late 2014. Chipotle finds spot near Gander Mountain in Raleigh. Along with the new Gander Mountain Outdoor Store, a Chipotle Mexican Grill restaurant is opening soon at the Triangle Plaza Shopping Center on Capitol Boulevard in North Raleigh. Chipotle will take a 3,028-square-foot end cap space at Triangle Plaza, formerly occupied by Majestic Nail Spa, confirms Brian Grabowski with Retail Rep, who represented the owner of the shopping center in the deal. The Nail Spa is moving to a small location under a new name. Chipotle is expected to open by late summer, he says. Chipotle Mexican Grill is also opening a new eatery later this summer at the Harvest Plaza Shopping Center at Strickland Road and Six Forks Road in North Raleigh, replacing the Burger King building that was torn down in February. And now we have the reporter page of Jason DeBrun, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The first headline, Boylan Clinic expands doctor-patient access. Tired of a busy waiting room, three Raleigh primary care docs change up their business model. As the healthcare landscape continues its long and winding change, doctors at Boylan Healthcare also switched up their business model. In an effort to capture patients who want more attention and are willing to pay extra, three doctors formed Boylan Clinic to offer a concierge medicine option to patients. Under this model, the doctors prefer terms like executive primary care or signature care to the word concierge. Doctors Todd Helton, Robert Smithson, and Charles Wiebe view patients almost more like members. These member patients pay an annual fee of $1,650, but have better access to the doctors throughout the year, and the doctors give patients more attention. Boylan will cap membership at $1,800 for the clinic, or $600 per doctor. That's well below the 4,000 or so patients each doctor had in his rotation before the change. We realized that a lot of people wanted more access to their doctor, says Helton. The shortage of primary care doctors has been well documented, and these doctors are now seeing as many as 24 patients per day. That leaves little time to focus on any one patient, something that led to a frustrating work environment. I was ready to pull my hair out, said Smithson. Under the new model, routine patient visits are as long as 30 minutes, and if a patient wants to talk about anything off-topic, we actually have time to do that, said Smithson. Outside the annual membership, the charge structure of the practice is very similar to that of a traditional practice, with applicable co-pays or deductibles applying in the standard way. Some patients were eager to join this model, even if it costs a little extra. Mary Riggin and her husband were among those who made the switch. They had been patients of Boylan for more than 45 years, but wanted more. Continuity of care was very important, and we wanted to have easier access to our physician, said Riggin. You need to be able to get in touch with your doctor when you need them. He or she, in turn, needs to be able to practice medicine the way they've been trained to do. They can't do that when they have huge numbers of patients to treat. The doctors at Boylan Clinic now see closer to 11 patients per day and have time to visit patients in the hospital if needed, something that has become a rarity in busier independent primary care practices, and as hospitalists have become more common. The clinic is wholly owned by Boylan Healthcare, which was founded in 1963 and is now under the UNC Physicians Network, part of UNC Healthcare. The larger group still offers a more traditional care model, so any patients can stay with Boylan, even if they move to a different part of the practice. Boylan Healthcare has six managing doctors, all equal owners. The three Boylan Clinic doctors are included as managing partners. With all of the changes in medicine and more uncertainty ahead, our goal is to offer our patients a different model of care, Helton said. We now have time to talk with our patients, go over all their concerns, and come up with a plan specifically for them. It brings back the past values of medicine. Rex wants to partner with Surgery Docs. Ambulatory surgery venture to be established at Wakefield facility. Rex Healthcare wants to recruit between 20 and 30 surgeons with whom to create a new joint venture ambulatory surgery center in Wakefield. The ambulatory surgery model, sometimes called outpatient or same-day surgery, has proven a cost saver for health systems. Research published in the academic journal Health Affairs estimates that procedures performed in these ambulatory surgery centers, or ASCs, take 32 fewer minutes than those performed in hospitals, a 25% difference relative to the mean procedure time. That translates to dollar savings between $363 and $1,000 per outpatient case, according to the paper. Some savings come simply because physicians have skin in the game. When surgeons operate in a hospital-based facility, They don't pay for the cost of the surgery, like electricity, for example, or surgery tools that can sometimes be very expensive. When those surgeons actually own the center, as in the joint venture model, it often makes them consider costs when performing each surgery. Rex, a subsidiary of UNC Healthcare, would transform the existing operating room at its Wakefield campus to the ASC, something that would cost less than $500,000 and involve minimal physical work. It would, however, include regulatory filings. Hospital executives say they are still in early talks and have not identified which surgeons they will partner with or the exact terms of the partnership. Biogen IDEC nearing finish line on RTP-made drug. Company closes in on European approval for new MS drug. Biogen IDEC received a positive recommendation from a European agency on its potential new drug, Plegridy, P-L-G-R-I-D-Y, a good sign in receiving final approval to market the drug in the European Union. Biogen IDEC received the notice from the Committee for Medicinal Products for Human Use, CHMP, of the European Medicines Agency, EMA, which refers its ruling to the European Commission, which grants marketing authorization in the EU. It's a similar process to receiving approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in this country. If approved, the multiple sclerosis drug, Plegridy, would be produced at the Biogen IDEC facilities here in the Triangle area. Biogen IDEC has two operations here, one off Davis Drive in Research Triangle Park and one in Mooresville. It has about 1,200 local employees. Plegridy is an injection treatment for relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, RRMS. Multiple sclerosis, MS, is a chronic, often disabling disease that attacks the central nervous system, which is made up of the brain, spinal cord, and optic nerves. Symptoms may be mild or severe, ranging from numbness in the limbs to paralysis or loss of vision. The progression, severity, and specific symptoms of MS are unpredictable and vary from one person to another. MS affects more than 2.3 million people worldwide, with more than 500,000 sufferers in the European Union, according to the MS International Federation. Relapsing forms of MS include relapsing remitting MS, RRMS, the most common form of the disease, accounting for 85% of cases. And along with this article, there's a by-the-numbers section. Biogen IDEC and GlaxoSmithKline, two biopharmaceutical behemoths with major Triangle operations, landed on a list of drug makers who have increased prices the most in the past few years. Bloomberg News compiled a list of 73 drugs that have seen the highest percentage price increase since 2007. Biogen landed on the list twice for treatments related to multiple sclerosis, and GSK was on the list for an epilepsy treatment. Shown are the drugs, the percent price increase, and the rank among the highest increase for all drugs on the list. Biogen IDEC, Avonex, ranked number 14, increased in price 147%, from $552 per injection in 2007 to $1,363 in 2014. Tysabri, ranked 45, increased in price 102% from $185 per injection in 2007 to $374 in 2014. And for GlaxoSmithKline, Lamictal, ranked 55, increased in price 92% from $4.91 per pill 2007 to $9.41 per pill in 2014. And now we have the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurism. The first headline, Taking the Sting Out of Soda. Clayton Inventor's device protects soft drink sippers from unwanted bees. You may know Clayton resident Robert Poole as your friendly neighborhood mailman. By day, he drives the streets of Durham, letter bag in tow, making sure your correspondence reaches you rain or shine. But by night, The double life takes over. The mailbag is put away, and out comes the can keeper. It's an invention born of bee stings and frustration, and one Poole hopes is his ticket to his own entrepreneurship exit story. He took a break from his mail duties to chat about the buzzy invention, so simple that he's banking this future, his future, and $68,000 on its success. It's really easy to sell when I'm able to show people how they work, he says. In all, he estimates 12,000 can keepers have been sold. People have to see me put the can in and close the lid and open it to show them how it works. It started with a phone call he made to his kids from an airport in Baltimore. He was just off the plane from Kuwait, where he was serving. I'm in the Air Force Reserve, he says. And he told his kids he'd do anything they wanted that weekend. They said, we want to go camping, so he packed his bag again and trekked his kids in tow to Cherokee. We loved it, he says. But there was a big problem. You couldn't put your drink down without a yellow jacket buzzing in it, he says. I had to put a paper towel on top of my drink and a rock. It made me think, gosh, I need a koozie that's got a lid on it. But when I started looking around, there was nothing that did that. So Poole's entrepreneurship began when he decided to solve the problem himself, creating a can keeper with a hinged lid to keep the bees out and a thermal base to keep your drinks cold. He raised $68,000 from family and friends to start producing the devices, and he recently started a Kickstarter campaign to raise $20,000 more. If that doesn't work, he tells me he'll seek institutional investment. The goal? To raise enough to refine distribution. The next step? Licensing college logos for the devices. He's already had some high-level conversations. One company is putting his technology in front of a focus group for a possible infomercial. His ultimate goal? To write his own exit story with the invention, and he's done it before. In the 90s, Poole invented a board game called Rules of the Game and was able to make more than $3 million in revenue over 5 years of sales. We ended up licensing the game to Hasbro, he tells me. But this idea, Poole's convinced it's so simple that people are bound to buy it. Via his website, the can keeper retails for less than $6, but as of Monday, the idea had yet to take off on Kickstarter. With 25 days to go, only $61 had been pledged of his $20,000 goal. I just need to create more buzz, he says, no pun intended. AT&T, DirecTV, deals impact on Triangle. AT&T is officially buying DirecTV in a deal valued at nearly $50 billion. I took a look at the securities filings to see how it might impact you, the customer. Here are five takeaways for current customers. Don't care about video? No problem. AT&T has pledged to continue to offer standalone broadband services at guaranteed prices for 3 years after the deal closes. Only a DirecTV customer? AT&T pledges to continue DirecTV's standalone service at nationwide package prices that are the same for all customers for at least 3 years after the deal closes. AT&T plans to use the merger to expand its plans to build and enhance high-speed broadband service in rural areas. That's on top of the fiber announcement the company has already made in North Carolina. AT&T will continue its commitment to net neutrality for at least 3 years after closing, regardless of what the FCC decides. And AT&T will offer bundles that include video, high-speed broadband, and mobile services using all of its sales channels, channels that include AT&T's 2,300 retail stores and its authorized dealers. And now in a section called Checking In, checking in with Iprio's site head. In April 2013, New York financial software firm Iprio made the high-profile decision to bring 250 jobs to downtown Raleigh. So, now that it's been a year since the announcement, I decided to check in with O'Hara Mackin, Executive Vice President and Managing Director at Iprio, to see how far along they are. We've been very fortunate, he says. The current headcount is 160, with the first analyst class, 17 additional hires, starting in the next 3 weeks. In January, he had told me the goal for the year was to be at a 150-person headcount by the end of the year. We continue to be very happy with our decision to open an office here, he says. We are way ahead of where we expected to be. Iprio is still hiring for everything from experienced product management professionals to junior product analyst roles. And in another section, overheard, first we have Rick Vandeveen, River City Capital's funds director, commenting after his firm raised a $200 million round. Cash will go towards startups. Past investments include SideQuest and StepLeader. His quote, "I'm on planes all the time. If I could invest all that locally, that would be great." And another quote from Jay Parker, "We saw a continued revenue growth as well as the profit margins growing." And Jay Parker is the head of North American operations at Lenovo, chatting hours after the global PC giant reported a fiscal year revenue of $38.7 billion. And finally, Gail Roper's quote, "We won't know how many huts until the network is designed." She's the chief information officer for the city of Raleigh, speaking after Raleigh approved leasing agreements for the fiber huts required to house Google Fiber. Raleigh is one of several cities under consideration for the service, and should it pick Raleigh, it would pay $2 per square foot for the structure. And finally, on this reporter page, we have a by the numbers section. First, it starts with a quote, "Higher education is economic development." That's from Charles Hayes, repeating the punchline of his speech at the State of the Region event. Hayes had numbers to back him up. 44%, that's how many adults have at least an associate's degree in the triangle. 280, more than 280 startup companies license university technology. And 14,587 patents granted from 2000 to 2011. And finally, we have the reporter page of Dawn Curry, who covers small business, personalities, and triangle trends. And the first headline is, six things you didn't know about new Terminal 1. Despite months of coverage on Raleigh-Durham International Airport's new $68 million Terminal 1, there is still plenty to be learned about the new digs. This terminal handles national flights and is designed to accommodate 3 million travelers annually. Two of the most surprising things I learned about the newly upfitted terminal were the cost of luggage cart rentals and that the no-smoking policy includes e-cigarettes. Terminal 1 has no mailbox for regular mail like Terminal 2 has, but it has something else. You're on your way to the TSA checkpoint and you just remember the taser in your purse or your pocket knife on your hip. To prevent TSA from confiscating it, stop at the airport mailer and send your belongings to yourself. Business meetings can be held in a terminal conference room. This is handy if you need to head out for another flight shortly. Airport staff say some people fly in for business and don't leave the airport until their return flights. If you brought too much to carry, such as golf clubs for a round at Pinehurst No. 2, you'll need at least $4 for a luggage cart. The automatic vendor takes $1 bills, $5 bills, or a credit debit card. When you return your cart, the machine gives you a 25-cent refund. Today's business traveler is generally equipped with more than one gadget. Underneath your seat in the concourse or the meeting place, you'll find an outlet and a USB plug-in place. Forgot your phone charger? Visit the ACC American Cafe. It features window seats overlooking the airstrip, local craft beers on tap, and a handy bonus, the evening bartender keeps a variety of phone chargers for forgetful travelers. Coming in town for a conference or event, representatives are standing by at a desk in the baggage claim area, ready to assist you with shuttles and other accommodations. And there's one other short article headlined, North Carolina to get its first craft beer incubator. The American Tobacco Campus and Capital Broadcasting are coming together in Rocky Mount to create North Carolina's first craft beer incubator in an old mill. A craft beer incubator, much like American Underground or HQ Raleigh, is a shared space in which craft brewers can use equipment, collaborate, and learn what it takes to get a craft brewery up and running. Capital Broadcasting has had the mill and property since about 2007 and has been looking for the right project that would support local economic development and create jobs. The gist of it is making craft beer an economic development tool for Eastern North Carolina, says Margot Knight Metzger, executive director of the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild. Eastern North Carolina, including Rocky Mount, has struggled economically for quite a long time. I think this project has the potential to put Rocky Mount on the map for manufacturing again, as well as make it a bona fide tourism destination. Still in the planning stages, the goal is to bring in enough equipment for 8 nano breweries and allow brewers to rent space and live in the mill village, allowing them to collaborate and be personal with their business. The mill sits on the Tar River, just a short drive from Raleigh on U.S. Highway 64. And this issue's executive voice in the Triangle Business Journal is Dr. Victor Zhao, DZAU, and it's headlined, Duke Health CEO Reflects on Career Life in Durham. And this question and answer session is written by Jason DeBrun. Dr. Victor Zhao, who for nearly a decade helmed the Duke University Health System and oversaw the medical school, will leave Duke University to become the next president of the Institute of Medicine. He plans to keep a residence in Durham and promised that he and his wife will stay involved locally. Before his last day on June 30, Zhao offered some reflections on Duke and looked ahead to his new position overseeing a congressionally chartered organization that advises the national health care policy. What was your proudest moment at Duke? I get that question a lot, and it's always the same answer. It's been a great 10 years, and the thing I am most proud of is our teamwork. The credit goes to a lot of people who make this place hum. I would say that overall, the way this place is, the quality of people and the passion of the people to do the right thing, to me, is the most exciting and important aspect. And Dr. Robert Lefkowitz, that was another very proud moment. Lefkowitz became the first Nobel laureate from Duke University in 2013. How is Duke different today than when you started 10 years ago? We are a place of high quality and great patient safety. We put the patient at the center. When I first came, we emphasized patient-centered care, putting the patient in the middle, as opposed to the doctors in the middle. As an organization, this has become our mantra. In addition, we are now reaching into the community and engaging with patients and their families to take charge of their own health. We here at Duke work deeply with the community in all the things that affect health, including education and poverty issues. When I first came, there were a lot of issues of trust with Duke, and the engagement wasn't there as much, and I feel that we are in a much better place today. What do you think you could have done better? There were a series of patient safety issues which happened before I came and shortly after I came, but I think we now proudly say that we are a national model of patient safety. We have a willingness to engage patients early on if there is a potential safety issue, and now have a culture that emphasizes patient safety. You say that you started engaging with the patients earlier. Is that something that Duke didn't do before you began your tenure here? Well, you've got to remember why you are here, which is serving the patients and their families. We are a service organization and also do a lot of great research and education, but you have to remember that your customer, so to speak, is the patient. What have you done to engage with patients more directly? One thing was that I created a patient efficacy council. There were people who were concerned that if we start listening to what patients have to say, it could affect how we start to do things. Obviously, our experience has been totally contrary. At every turn, patient engagement has helped us do a better job. Whether it is how to care for the patients or how to engage with the families, we even engaged with patients when it came to designing the new buildings. How has Duke been able to impact the greater Durham community? Health is a lot more complex issue than just a healthcare. It's got to do with jobs, with the economy, with education, homelessness, food security, transportation. We've been engaged with the community outside Just Duke's campus. I chair a task forum called Made in Durham, in which we want to help youth connect with education. We believe that will lead to better health. You are not only the head of the health system, but also oversee the medical school. How do those two roles interact with each other? Look at the research and innovation that is being done here. When you want to improve health and healthcare, you've got to bring in new ways of doing things. We bring a lot of innovation to healthcare. Just to give one example, we are now mapping patients and mapping their communities so we can begin to learn how to intervene and prevent illness. We have one of the best research institutions here and are able to use that innovation on the medical school side to create better outcomes on the healthcare side. What are you looking forward to most at the IOM? I hope to take a lot of the lessons I learned here with me. The Institute advises all major branches of the government on issues of health, and I look forward to taking what I learned from Duke and applying that to shaping policy for the country. You are well aware that the topic of healthcare has become highly politicized. How can you, in your role at the IOM, keep healthcare focused on issues and facts instead of political spin? One of the essential foundations of the Institute is that it's not political. It's independent. It gives authoritative advice that it's trustworthy. And that's because it's nonpartisan. We are very careful to steer a non-political course, and that's why the government comes to us. Take, for instance, an issue like, does vaccination increase autism? The government can't turn to the people who make vaccines. They can't turn to a patient advocacy group. They can turn to a university, but that's only one opinion. The IOM is the authoritative organization that has a deep bench of hundreds and hundreds of employees who have PhDs and master's degrees, and they all want to do the right thing. They make a recommendation as a unit that is trustworthy. Still, those recommendations seem to gain a political twist once they are accepted by those in politics. How can we in the news media or in the general public think more like the folks at the IOM? From a national healthcare perspective, we certainly need that conversation that is neutral. I think what's unique about the IOM is that because of who it can really bring together anybody. You can get the world's leading experts all together to tackle an issue. When they come together, you know their views will be balanced with other points of view, so the report comes out as an authoritative report, almost like a Supreme Court judgment. It's always important to know why we are here. The news media can do a good job by staying objective and putting out accurate information. It's about improving health, and if we improve health, we improve as a nation because we improve our economy. We have people who are able to be more productive. And in a closer look section, concerning Dr. Zhao, age 67, years at Duke, 10, new position, President, Institutes of Medicine, effective July 1st, residence, Durham, family, wife, Ruth, two daughters, scientific breakthrough, led research on what are now widely used ACE inhibitors. And in the People on the Move section, the spotlight is on Tim Tompkins, Chief Sustainability Officer at the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. Fundraising is the name of the game for Tim Tompkins, the new Chief Sustainability Officer at the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits. In fact, raising funds and leading business development efforts has been his job for the better part of his professional career. After a decade in director of business development roles, Tompkins will lean on those experiences in his new role. As CSO, Tompkins works to prepare the center to better support nonprofits and make those organizations not only sustainable, but help them stretch their funds more effectively and efficiently through the center's services. He also works to highlight the center's various cost-saving programs. The North Carolina Center for Nonprofits' mission is to enrich the state's communities and economy through a strong nonprofit sector and nonprofit voice. The Raleigh-based center has about 1,500 member nonprofits and is helmed by its president, Jane Kendall. What one thing you wish people knew about your job? Or what's one thing you wish people knew about your job? I wish people knew the tremendous economic development impact nonprofits have in our state. While many know that nonprofits have an incredible impact on human needs, ranging from food banks to mentoring to education to health issues, most don't know that 1 out of 9 jobs in our state are in the nonprofit sector. What are some of your major goals in this position? To highlight the many intersections between the corporate sector and the nonprofit sector, and the interdependency between them that allows us to have the great communities that North Carolina has been known for decades. Biggest pet peeve? Professionally, people who don't follow up on what they say they will do. In the world at large, hypocrisy. At home, my 1-year-old daughter inadvertently, yet repeatedly, punching me in the epiglottis while I hold her. Biggest challenge? My biggest professional worry is that we will continue to have people in need on waiting lists or underserved at nonprofits that help them purely because of resource constraints. Triangle business person you most admire. I admire all entrepreneurs who start something from scratch and build it, especially people like Henry Kastner, co-founder of Bandwidth.com. And in our final minute, we'll read from the 9 to 5 column. Something's in the oven in Raleigh. Bolted Bread, a new bread shop featuring craft bread and pastries made from locally sourced grains, has opened at 614 West South Street in downtown Raleigh. The shop features 4 regular breads, levain, seeded, baguette, and rye. The bakery also has a bread share program, somewhat similar to a CSA program. Pre-ordered bread is available for pickup on Wednesdays and Fridays. The bread is also available at the Raleigh City Farmers Market, held on Wednesdays at the historic City Market. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.